Welcome, everyone. This is the first office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economic Government Intervention, which we're going through the final third of the textbook lessons for the young economist. And today is April 26, 2014. So for those of you who are tuned in live here, just in case some of you are new, the way this works, it's just a free for all. So go ahead and you can do it right in the chat box. You don't need to do it in a separate Q&A box. Just type whatever questions you want me to field to pop into your mind. And especially when these sessions first start, don't be shy. It's better for you to type in something and get me going than have me awkwardly look at the camera. All right, while people are thinking, I'll tackle something. The what's in the blogosphere buzz right now is a lot of major, I don't know what you want to call them, policy wonks, analysts, some are actual professional economists, have been bouncing around the idea of a requirement for 100% reserve banking. And so that's interesting to Rothbardian, since that's actually a standard Rothbardian position that they want banks to have 100% reserves. So let me just make sure people understand what that is. That when you go to a commercial bank and you give a deposit, so just look. Pretend that we're in the United States here and we're talking about that scenario. So you have $100 in cash, green pieces of paper. You go into a commercial bank, you give it to them, and then now they show on their computers that you have $100 on deposit in the checking account. Now, if they just took that currency, the green pieces of paper, and put it in a vault, then that wouldn't have changed the overall quantity of money. It just would have changed the form. Instead of you walking around with $100 currency in your wallet, the bank would be holding it on your behalf, and then the number in your checking account, the electronic number, would just correspond to that. And so when you wrote a check or swiped your debit card in a store, the bank would transfer the money to them. So it's just a technological innovation. It's just like instead of having your wallet be in your pocket, it's like that your wallet is at this building with a bunch of solid walls around it and armed guards, that sort of thing. Right? But it wouldn't economically change the nature of what was happening. That's with 100% reserve banking, because what that means is you look at a given commercial bank and look at all of its customers and add up their checking account balances, and then the bank has on reserve that exact amount in the form of the narrower money, okay? And I mean narrow, meaning when economists define different types of things to call money, clearly in the United States, green pieces of paper issued by or printed by the Treasury, it's a Federal Reserve note on them, you know, that's clearly money in terms of, I mean, it's not a good money, but if anything in the U.S. right now counts as money, given the system, that's so certainly money. And then what's not as obvious, though, is, well, what if I have money on deposit with a commercial bank? So I actually don't have the $100 bill or the $10 bills or $5, $20 bills. When I say I have $100 in my possession, what if what I mean by that is there is some large commercial bank like Bank of America or Citibank or whatever, Fifth Third, that according to their records, I have $100 on deposit with them. Is that the same thing? You know, should we say that that's like I have $100? Should I walk around thinking I have $100? So you see, that's a different thing. under 100% reserve banking, the two would be pretty much equivalent, as long as you didn't think the bank was going to burn down, get robbed or something.
Okay.
But if there's not 100% reserve banking, then they're economically distinct. It's like for people trickling in, just in case we have newcomers who don't know how the stuff works, by all means, if you have questions that pop into your head, even if it has nothing to do with what I'm talking about, go ahead and type it in to the chat box, because that'll tell me when to end my current pontificating and talk about something else. But if you guys aren't typing in anything, then I gotta just keep winging it. So if there's what's called fractional reserve banking, that means the commercial banks only keep on deposit a fraction of reserves to back up what all their customers think they have on deposit. And so if you have fractional reserve banking, that opens up the possibility for a bank run. So one of the points, or one of the themes that Rothbardians stress, is that the public has this idea that by their very nature, banks are subject to a dreaded bank run. That if for some reason the public gets nervous and a lot of people go to the bank to try to get their money out at the same time, the bank is going to fail, and that's just the way banks work. And the Rothbardians stress that's incorrect. That's the way fractional reserve banking works. That by their very nature, fractional reserve banks can be brought to their knees at any moment if there's just, a panic breaks out. Okay, and so that's, but the point is, that's not something inherent to banking per se. That's something inherent to fractional reserve banking. If banks were 100% reserve, it wouldn't matter if there were a bank panic. If 90% of the depositors all lined up at 9 a.m. when the bank opened its door, give us our money, the banks could say, okay, and they'd open up the vault and they would have everybody's money in there because it's 100% reserve. The bank might go out of business in the sense that without a lot of customers, it doesn't make sense to stay as a business, just like if a gas station, if it only gets two customers a week, is probably going to go out of business. But it's not that they were caught promising things they couldn't deliver from a bankrupt. You see the difference there? So that's one of the things Rothbardians stressed about 100% reserve banking. And so anyway, it's just kind of interesting that now, I was just reading Paul Krugman's talking about it and weighing the pros and cons of a government policy that enforces 100% reserve banking. So it's interesting that it went from being a fringe nut job Rothbardian crazy idea a couple of years ago to now all of a sudden respectable mainstream economists are openly discussing the idea. So it's kind of shocking. Okay, we have more people trickling in. I can keep talking about this, or I can start talking about other things, guys, but it makes me feel more comfortable if somebody throws out something, because then I know at least I'm answering one person's concerns. Okay, great. Jed says, I believe in one of the two courses that precede this course, you said there is little distinction between socialism and communism. Isn't it accurate to distinguish fascism from the other two isms, even if the outcomes are similar? Okay, Jed, I'm not saying you're wrong. I've often said stuff and people quote it back to me. I can't believe I said that. So I don't know what the context was, and I very well may have said what you're saying. But for the record right now, let me distinguish between those three words, namely socialism, communism, fascism. So, and here I'm relying on what I believe is the way Ludwig von Mises distinguished among them. So, socialism means, or at least the way I use the term and I think about it, is a type of organization, and it has to do with ownership, and it means a system in which there's a state, and it, well, Yeah, I mean, because it's, I think there are people who would call themselves anarchists and also socialists, and so they would disagree with this. So it gets tricky as to, does there have to be a state, or is it just society owns it? I'm not going to get into that because that gets pretty philosophical, but for sure, if, let me distinguish between socialism and communism. Socialism, one plausible definition is to say it means the state apparatus owns all the means of production, or all of the really big and important means of production. Like, it can let individual carpenters still own hammers and stuff like that, but any big equipment, any factories for sure, farmland, stuff like that, that the government owns. That's socialism, whereas communism also has to do with the particular way in which you achieve socialism. And I think this is the way Mises used the terms. So you could have, in principle, you could have a democratic, with a small d, revolution and expropriation, right? So people could just vote in a socialist government that could then nationalize all the means of production. And so that would be now a socialist system, but it was just, you know, elected on democratic grounds and so forth, and that's the way you got to it. Maybe just there was an educational effort, or you could call it a propaganda effort if you don't think it's a good idea, and the people, enough people became believers in socialism and they supported it. Okay. Whereas communism has the idea of class struggle, where the proletariat violently overthrows the, you know, the bourgeoisie master, you know, the capitalist class. Okay, and so that's, I think that's the distinction that Mises made. I mean, he would be much more eloquent and scholarly about it, give you more footnotes, but I think that was the way Mises distinguished it. So a communist revolution would lead to socialism, but it was a particular way to get there. And also, just communism per se, you know, involved class ideology. Whereas you could be a socialist and not believe in violent overthrow of the existing order, that sort of thing. And then fascism, at least the way I use the term, is under fascism, people are still nominally allowed to own private property, right? So businesses, you know, there are still shopkeepers and things like that. You could say, this factory, who owns it? Any common man wouldn't say, oh, the government. They would say, you know, Jim Smith, who lives down the street, he owns that factory. Or this group of 10 shareholders, they own that factory. But it's a heavily regulated system in which, even though Jim Smith may, in theory, be the owner of that factory, he can't make any important decisions without the government approving it. And so he's ultimately doing what the government says, but he's considered the owner. So that's in terms of the economic system. So now, historically, also, fascism is associated with, you know, certain type of nationalism and militarism and things like that. But in terms of economic systems, that's to me what distinguishes socialism from fascism. And so when people say, like, oh, Barack Obama and whatever, he's giving up socialism, I don't think it's more accurate to say the U.S. right now is, it either is a fascist state or it's heading in that direction. I think that's what the U.S. would be. It would not work with the American people and the way they've been brought up in the educational system for the government to literally nationalize everything, because they would recoil and say, "Wait a minute, that's socialism. We've been, you know, didn't we fight that? Didn't we beat them in the Cold War?" Right. So they, you have to, if you wanted the state to gain a large degree of control over the lives and businesses of Americans, you would have to implement fascism. And you wouldn't call it fascism, obviously, because they've been taught that that's a bad thing, too. You'd call it democracy. All right, other questions? Okay, Jed says, can the words communism and Marxism be used interchangeably? Also, what is a good primer on communist thought? Do I read what Marxists say or what Mises says? Okay, great. Yeah, and I had to catch myself because as I was describing to you communism, I realized I was veering into Marxism. All right, so Marxism involves a particular understanding of how economics works, or I should say how economies work. And so in other words, you can be a Marxist economist, whereas it doesn't quite make as much sense to say you're a communist economist. I mean, you could be, but it's like saying somebody's a French economist or a Spanish economist or a Russian economist. Like, you could use the label to describe somebody, but it would be two separate things describing the person. It wouldn't be an adjective describing the type of economics, if that makes sense. So, like if you're a Chicago school economist, that means something in particular. That's the type of economics to which you subscribe. The same thing with Marxism, that entails a particular view of a particular type of economic theory and also an understanding of history is what makes you a Marxist. And so, for example, the idea that under a capitalist system, there's the progressive immiseration of the proletariat that, left to its own devices, a capitalist system naturally, drives down the living standards of the workers. A particular understanding of the source of profit in a market economy. So there's a Marxist understanding of how output is allocated among the various classes in the capitalist system. All right, and obviously the Marxist worldview doesn't think it's a good outcome, but the point is it is a scientific understanding to say this is how wages are set in a capitalist system. It has to do with the iron law of wages. They get pushed down to the bare minimum so the workers don't starve. And then given that, you can figure out, okay, well, if the workers actually produce more than they need to survive, then that gap or that surplus is what the capitalists get to skim off the top, right? And so they have a particular theory of how is it that a capitalist can invest money in an enterprise, hiring workers, buying physical resources, and then make goods and services and sell them to customers, and then end up getting more money out of that enterprise than he put in the beginning. And so that's what the capitalist views as interest or profit, or whatever you want to call it. And so the Marxist says, well, it's not because the capitalist contributed anything. No, the capitalist is sitting back, letting everybody else do all the work, and letting the other owners of genuinely productive factors contribute them. The capitalist is just sitting there overseeing the whole thing. And so how is it he's able to skim off the top? Well, in the Marxist system, it's because the workers are being underpaid. The workers are not being paid the full value of their labor. And so the workers contribute, if a worker contributes $100 of output to the operation, but his wages only gets paid $60, well, that $40 surplus, what happened to it, according to Marxists, oh, that's what funnels into the earnings of the capitalists. Right? So that's, so you could be a socialist without subscribing to that particular theory. You could be a communist without subscribing to that particular explanation of where does interest come from in a market economy. But if you're a Marxist, I think that has a connotation that you subscribe to Karl Marx's economic analysis. Also, and by the way, there's lots of contradictions in this too, that another tenet of Marxism is that the historical progression of an economy through various stages is just an inexorable law of history. And so it's set up, so they're saying, just as there was the feudal period, and then that gave way to capitalism, by the same token, capitalism will ultimately give way to socialism or communism, and that it's inevitable. There's no point in fighting it. It's just that's the way it works. So on the one hand, it's inspiring for the believers in that, because they think, you know, they just their victory is imminent, or not imminent, but unstoppable. But then on the other hand, Mises points out there's contradictions there, that certain places Marx is saying there's nothing you can do. It's not just that you can't stop it, but you can't accelerate it either. That capitalism will not fall until it is fully developed, you know, into its fruition, and then bursts asunder because of its internal logical contradictions. And so Mises points out, if anything, if you were a consistent Marxist, you would advocate that governments around the world get rid of taxes, or lower taxes, and get rid of capital controls and all sorts of regulations on business, because you can't get to the communist stage of history until the capitalist stage fully ripens. And so you either, no matter, either you have no influence at all, or you have to get the constraints out of the way to let capitalism develop as quickly as possible if you want to speed along its demise. And so the last thing in the world you would do if you were a Marxist would support piecemeal government interventions to regulate the market economy. And yet, in practice, that's what a lot of Marxists do. They realize they don't politically have the power to get their countrymen to go along with full-blown communism, and so they, you know, advocate weaker things. Just like, I'm sure, the Marxists teaching in U.S. universities welcomed the Affordable Care Act, you know, what's called Obamacare, even though technically that's not their preferred plan. They say, well, that's better than what we got right now. But strictly speaking, Mises is saying, if you're a Marxist, you shouldn't do that. That's inconsistent with Marx's analysis of the laws of history and how economic systems transform into their successors. So, Jed, as far as what should you read, well, I think Mises does a good job of explaining the Marxist system. You know, so it's not just that he says, like, oh my gosh, there are a bunch of commies, and, you know, does a couple of straw man attacks and moves on or something. I mean, it's Mises. He's very scholarly. He cites stuff and really tries to understand the system. But I think it's just in general, if you want to make sure you're being fair to a particular group of thinkers, you should read them in the original. And in particular, if you think that your side has some damning critique, you would want to find people who are alive right now who still believe in the thing that you think has been discredited, and then see what they have to say about it. Right. So, for example, you know, I thought it's really instructive to go read Oscar Lange responding to Mises' argument about socialist calculation. And then you can see for yourself that he answered Mises wrong. And Bumbavirk, actually, who came before Mises, he has a whole thing called Karl Marx and the Close of His System. And that's pretty technical, but it's just devastating. So I actually think in terms of not what a lot of normal people today think of as Marxism. I think most people right now think of Marxism as, oh, the government just takes over everything and gives equal portions to people or something like that. And that's Marxism. But no, Marxism as an economic worldview and set of theories to explain market phenomena, I think Bumbavirk destroyed that more than Mises did. In particular, the Marxist explanation of interest. Well, I mean, Bumbavirk just, in my mind, obliterated it. If you want, let me see, like, I can probably find it really fast here. I can give you an example of what I mean. Let's see, so Robert Bumbavirk, exploitation theory. Yeah, so here, I'll paste it in a thing, but if people are listening to this, the title of the article is Bumbavirk's Critique of the Exploitation Theory of Interest. So I wrote it in the Mises Daily. It's Mises.org/daily/1680. This is fairly easy, but I'll paste it in here. So if you want to see that, Jed, to give an example of what I mean. So if that's the kind of stuff you're after, then Bumbavirk's really good. And you can go read his, I think it's called Karl Marx and the Close of the System, where he just goes through and points out, just to give you guys a flavor of it. Bumbavirk says, well, okay, according to Marx, then, remember I just talked to you a minute ago about the way that capitalists earn interest is that the workers are underpaid. They're not paid the full value of their profit. And the wages they get. And that's the source of this surplus that the capitalists then skim off the top. So Bumbavirk said, okay, well, if that's true, then we should, there are industries that have different proportions in terms of their inputs, that some industries are very capital intensive, like, now I'm giving the examples, like an offshore oil rig. All right, when you know there's an oil platform that's several miles off the coast, and you know they drill down in the ocean floor and they pump up oil and stuff. That is a very capital intensive operation. Yeah, they do have some workers on the rig, but when you look at how much total money does that business spend in order to bring those barrels of crude oil to market, most of the money is spent on the heavy equipment. You know, to build that infrastructure and stuff, not the wages they're paying to the workers. That's relatively minor compared to those humongous expenditures to get all that equipment into place. In contrast, a hair salon is labor intensive, right? So if you look at the expenses of a hair salon over the course of a year, most of it would be paying the stylist to be sitting there selling their hours of time cutting people's hair. Because you don't really need that much equipment to set up a hair salon. You just kind of need the building and some scissors and, you know, little jars with the disinfectant or whatever, and some brushes and hair dryers, stuff like that. But it's not like you have to spend millions and millions of dollars just to get a hair salon up and running before you can hire anybody. Okay, so the point is, if you're a capitalist, according to Marx, you should be earning a much higher rate of return on your investment if you invest in hair salons than if you invest in oil rigs. Because remember, the source of your profit or your interest is that workers are underpaid. Because capitalists are not underpaid. If you buy, according to Marx, if you buy an oil tanker that's going to go back and forth, bringing the crude oil from your rig to the refinery on shore, you pay the full value of what that thing is worth. So the guy selling you the oil tanker is not getting ripped off by you. You have to pay him the true value of what that oil tanker's output's going to be. So where you're gaining that margin is when you hire workers. And so Bumbavirk's point was, well, if I invest $1 million in hair salons versus $1 million in the oil offshore oil platform, the total amount of surplus that I reap should be higher in the hair salons, because most of my money there is going to hire workers whom I underpay, according to Marx. And so then if I've invested the same amount and I earn more profit in the hair salon industry, well, then the rate of return on my investment is higher in the hair salons than the oil rigs. But from Bobber's point is that's obviously not true empirically. Empirically, rates of return on investment tend to be equalized across industries, except maybe for risk. But there certainly is not this systematic pattern where you get a higher rate of return based on how much labor is involved. And so Bobber's point is that clearly the Marxist system can't account for that. That's not even close. And then the Marxists tried to answer that, and Bobber just, you know, surveys their responses and shows that they're not even close to answering that objection. All right, so what's neat about that is most people probably don't even know that that was a part of Marxism, and yet Bobber titles his thing Karl Marx and the Close of His System, thinking I just blew up Marx, you know, so it's kind of interesting. But it's, let me say this, I mean, Marxists, actual people who actually call themselves Marxists, I don't mean people that Sean Hannity or Glenn Beck labels Marxists. I mean bona fide academics, people who write books and call themselves Marxists. They're very intelligent, or they contain people in that group that are very intelligent, so they're not dumb, and they're very literate, and you know, they can cite all sorts of stuff, and they would be able to write long essays with all kinds of big words and footnotes and stuff. And so it's good to for you to be exposed to that if you're really interested in this. Okay. Michael Schmidt says, about calculation, the central planners do not have monetary prices of factors of production, but they, being Marxists, would probably say, we'll calculate everything in terms of labor hours. That'll be our common denominator for calculation. What problems will they run into? Okay, that's a great question. And I think you're right. I think some of them did propose that. But not, incidentally, Lange and Lerner. You know, the market socialists did not try to do a labor theory of value. So I think what they would run into, just all of the things that are wrong with the labor theory of value in general. Right? So remember, there was, I mean, it's not a Marxist thing. The classical economists, guys like Adam Smith and David Ricardo and John Stuart Mill, and even, I'm pretty sure even Frederick Bastiat, that they had at least some variant of what we would now call a labor theory of value. And it's not because they thought workers were being exploited under capitalism or something like that. No, just they were, when they were trying to understand the ultimate constraints and the determinants of market prices, it seemed to them that ultimately the bottleneck on production was the onerousness of human labor. And so that, you know, that ultimately when you say, well, how come if consumers are willing to pay whatever, $10 for units of this thing, how come producers don't just keep giving them more and more units to push down the price to zero? Ultimately, the constraint they thought was, well, because you got to get workers to be willing to do that. So the logic was, I mean, they knew workers had to use natural resources. It wasn't just literally raw labor power, but they were saying the earth or nature doesn't charge us for those resources. Right, you can go pick an apple, and it's not that you have to give money to the tree and pay the worker to climb the tree and grab the apple. No, you've got to pay the worker, but you get the apple for free. I think that was the mentality. So, but the problem is that just, it doesn't work. That's wrong. if you just think it through, and so guys like Bumbaver actually, I think probably gave the most systematic critique of the labor theory of value. So just to make sure you don't lose my answer, Michael, or yeah, I didn't see your name right. It's, if they did do that, it would just be wrong. All right, and so I'll try to give you some examples. I want you guys to post other questions so you get a better intuitive sense of what I mean. But the answer is they could plug in labor hours, but that would not be the right answer. Just like they could do it in terms of weight, physical weight. You know, they could say, well, we want to figure out what the relative valuation should be of like this tractor and these pounds of, these sacks of grain and these high-speed computers and these hammers and these barrels of crude oil. These are all different physical things, and we need to know how do we say in terms of our calculation when we come up with a grand plan, what substitution ratio should we plug in? Like if we can make a product, if we can make it one way and it uses a certain amount of resources, or we can make it a different way, and that different way means we use one fewer barrel of crude oil, but we use two more cords of firewood. And so is that cheaper or not, or is it more efficient or not to do it that way? Ultimately, what that's asking is, what's more valuable to society, a barrel of crude oil or two cords of firewood? That's the question. And then whatever one's more valuable, we should do the production technique that doesn't use that thing. Excuse me. Right, just like, in case I'm losing you guys, go back to capitalism for a minute. If you're a business owner and you want to produce a product and there's two technological ways to do it, and one way uses one barrel less of crude oil but uses two more cords of firewood, or the other way doesn't use those two cords of firewood but you have to get another barrel of oil, how do you figure out what to do? You say, well, what are their prices? And then you do it the cheaper way. So if a barrel of crude oil has a higher market price than two cords of firewood, you produce it the way that uses the wood. That's cheaper. So you get the product you're making, you sell it for the revenue, and your expenses are lower. But if the two cords of firewood combined have a higher market price than the barrel of oil, you choose the production technique that uses more oil and less firewood. Because again, you're trying to minimize your costs if your holding output is given. Right? That's one way of thinking about it. Okay, so the planners, the central planners and the socialists don't have market prices, so they can't use that criterion. So I'm saying they could, nothing is stopping them. They could just say, let's weigh the things and say, how much does a barrel of crude oil weigh and how much does two cords of firewood weigh? And whichever one weighs more, that's most socially valuable to us. And so we should always try to produce things with the technique that uses the lightest in terms of physical weight resources. So they could do that, and that would solve the problem, but it would obviously be wrong. I mean, that just would be crazy. We could just come up with all kinds of examples where, you know, they would be using computers to be like doorstops or something. Right? You know, you get the idea. Like, that's such a palpably absurd solution that's clearly, I hope I don't have to elaborate on why that would not work, and that they certainly have not met Mises' objection if they did that. Okay, so by the same token, less insane but still wrong would be if they said, let's look and see how many labor hours went into the production of the various things. So how many labor hours did it take to bring this barrel of crude oil into our possession, versus how many labor hours did it take to give us these two cords of firewood? And then that's the criterion by which we'll decide. Well, again, that's just wrong. That For one thing, different barrels of crude oil might have taken different numbers of labor hours, right? Crude oil in Saudi Arabia comes to the surface very easily. Crude oil that you get from an offshore oil rig is very difficult to bring to the surface. Now, and also, by the way, there's slight differences in the actual product. All right, so, but let's not worry about that right now. Even if they were the same physical substance, okay? Now, in a market economy, what does that mean? It means the people who own the Saudi Arabian oil fields earn more profit per barrel, or profit might not be the right word, but earn more net per barrel, net income per barrel, than the people in the offshore oil rigs. And so at any given time, the market price of oil is determined by, on the margin, the barrels of oil that are the most expensive to bring to market. Because those people have to just be barely breaking even, accounting for interest and risk and stuff like that. And then what's called the inframarginal producers are gaining what you might call pure rents. All right, so if the offshore oil rig, if they need to make $90 a barrel to make it worthwhile, and they're in operation, the world price of oil is $90 a barrel. And so if the guys in Saudi Arabia can bring the oil to surface and would be willing to sell it for 30, but instead they're getting 90, well, then they make that $60 difference as a, you know, pure income. Okay, but the point is, a barrel of oil has the same value to society in terms of its contribution to output, regardless of what its history is. And so if you did use labor hours as your criterion, you would end up, you know, you could have a bunch of barrels of oil sitting there, and you'd be about to grab one of them and do the production process, and they'd say, whoa, don't use that one. Use barrel number 10. And you say, why? They say, oh, because barrel number 10 came from Saudi Arabia. So go ahead and use that. But barrel number 1 came from an offshore oil platform. You can't use that. That's way too valuable. But yet the barrels would be containing, let's suppose, identical quantities of actual product. And so, like, if you look the other way and somebody switched all the labels, it wouldn't affect anything. Okay, and so that should, you know, tell you, wait a minute, something's screwy here. You know, you shouldn't need to know what the history of something was to know how valuable it would be right now. Or a different idea, if you're walking in the forest and you happen to see a hammer lying on the ground, it's not like you'd be walking around completely ignorant of how useful it was to you because you didn't know where it came from, right? Or you wouldn't say, well, this hammer's really not very valuable. This hammer's just valuable to me as a twig because it took me the same amount of labor power to get both of them, right? Or if aliens just showed up and as a gift gave us 1 gallon that, you know, every little thimbleful would cure cancer, and they just gave it to us as a gift, it would be totally wrong to say, well, we could just use that, you know, just to give it away. Let's say it tasted good too, and say, well, we could just give that away, you know, at lunch at a restaurant, just pour that as a free drink for people when they come in, you know, like, hey, you can get water, not, they don't charge it, because after all, it didn't take us any labor to get it, because the aliens just gave it to us. No, that would be the most valuable thing on earth per liquid ounce. And so you dispense that extremely cautiously because we've only got a gallon of it and it can cure cancer. The thimbleful that it gives to people, that person's now cured of cancer. You would guard that thing with your life, even though it didn't take any labor power to get it from our point of view. All right, so I'm hoping I'm just driving home that the labor theory of using the labor theory of value would lead to absurdities, and also it would just clearly be wrong. You would end up squandering things that were extremely valuable but didn't happen to have taken a lot of labor power. And ultimately, that's because the labor theory of value is itself wrong. It's just empirically, it's not correct to say the importance we attribute to some scarce item has to do with or is directly proportional to how much labor power some humans contributed to give it to us to make it available. That's just, it's not true. And so if the government draws up economic plans as if it were true, you're not going to come anywhere close to sex to using resources most efficiently, just as if they allocated resources on the basis of their physical weight, that would be insane and we would be extremely poor. Okay, you guys got other questions? It's that you guys are asking really deep questions here. This is, I'm not just saying, it's not like I say that every semester. Like this, these are really deep questions. Let me also say for those who may be like homeschoolers that are younger and you're hearing this stuff, don't panic. Again, this is just, I'm answering the questions that are thrown at me, but I'm not going to quiz you on what was Karl Marx's explanation for the source of interest. Okay, well, let me, while you guys are thinking of possibly another question, we've got about 13 minutes left, so we certainly have time for one more good one, if you got one. Let me just circle back to what I was talking about in the beginning, in case some people aren't familiar with that, about fractional reserve banking. I just want to make sure we clear up a worry someone might have. You might say, wait a minute, but how can banking even work if banks aren't allowed to lend out the reserves or some of them? So make sure I'm not losing you guys. Why would commercial banks not have 100% reserves? Because they would lend them out to other people. So you go in with your $100 in cash, currency, you give it to the commercial bank, they now credit your account, they add $100 to it, to your electronic checking account balance, you go and check the ATM, and now that number is $100 higher, okay? But the bank takes that $100 in cash and maybe only puts $10 literally in the vault, and then the other 90, they lend out to somebody else. And now that person owes the bank $90. And so the bank is earning interest on that because they charge interest on their loans. So that's the incentive for the bank to lend out its reserves. The downside is it's more vulnerable. The more it lends out, the smaller margin of error it has in case a lot of people show up unexpectedly to get their money back. But the more it lends out, that's a higher volume of loans out there that are rolling over in interest. And so the bank earns more income the more it lends out, right? So that's why the bank would want to do it, but it has limits. It can't be too reckless or else it might get caught with its pants down. Okay, so and so I think most people, when they learn about that, it just sounds natural to them. Like, oh, well, yeah, well, the bank has to be able to make money. It's a business. So obviously, if I give them my money to hold on my behalf, of course the bank's going to lend some of it out, because otherwise, how's the bank going to earn money? And so, of course, you need fractional reserve bank, but that's not true. There's different proposals as to how could a bank stay in business if it had 100% reserve banking. But the point is that it would have to charge money some other way. So, for example, it might say that if you keep your money on deposit with us in a checking account, you pay us a flat fee per year. Or it could maybe charge you a small amount, like every time you do a transaction, it might charge you whatever, 50 cents. Every time you swipe your debit card, you get ding. It's, you know, if you buy something for $20 from the store and swipe your debit card and you look at your statement at the end of the month, your checking account balance goes down by the 20 that you paid the store and a 50 cent fee to your bank for the privilege of maintaining your deposits and giving you a card and, you know, servicing you so you can walk around town and swipe the card and not have to carry cash. Right? So there's various ways, or they could just charge you interest. So instead of you earning interest on your checking account balance, technically it'd be like they were paying you a negative interest rate. It would probably be kind of small. And so if you didn't do anything and just left your money sitting there, it would kind of get, it would shrink over time. All right, so there's various ways that they could have 100% reserve banking and the banks could earn money. It could also be, too, that banks could engage in genuine loan transactions. So make sure you're not making the opposite mistake. So to be in favor of 100% reserve banking like Murray Rothbard was, you still think there's an important role for banks to play as what's called a credit intermediary, someone standing in between borrowers and savers. And so it would still be the case if people wanted to save money and put it in a safe place like a bank, and then the bank would be the one to interview potential borrowers and decide which loans were risky and which loans were safe and blah, blah, blah. That could still all happen with 100% reserve banking. The issue is, if you want to lend your money to the bank and earn interest, you would open up a savings account, not a checking account, or a more formal distinction. It's called demand deposits versus time deposits. So a demand deposit means your money is available upon demand. So under 100% reserve banking, if you have a demand deposit with the bank, it can't lend that out because it's saying to you contractually, if you show up whenever you want, we'll give you your money. So the only way it can satisfy that for sure is if it keeps the money in the vault. But if a time deposit says you're giving us the deposit for a minimum time period, and so you do not have the right to just show up and get your money back, but we're not promising you will have it. And then they could pay you interest on that. So an obvious popular market example of all this is a certificate of deposit or a CD. So what happens there, if you buy a CD from a bank, maybe you give them $1,000 today, and the bank says, okay, 1 year from now, we will give you $1,030. So that means you're earning 3% on the CD. So you give the bank the cash, and they give you this legal document that says Citibank owes the bearer of this document $1,030 on April 24th, 2015. Okay, so at that point, you know, your money is gone. You have an asset. You gave up $1,000 worth of money, and now you have what has presently a market value of $1,000 as of a bond issued by Citibank, but your cash has gone down by $1,000 because a bond from Citibank is not the same thing as money. Okay, so in that transaction, the total money supply in the economy didn't go up. And then if you need money tomorrow, you can't just go up to Citibank and say, hey, give me my money back. They're going to say, no, we don't owe you anything. Look at that thing. It says on April 24th, 2015, we owe you $1,030. It's not yet that date, so we don't owe you anything. Now, what you can do is you can go out into the market and sell that CD to somebody who wants it and get whatever cash they're willing to pay you for it. So bank CDs are very liquid. And so if you get hard up for money, you're better off holding a bank CD than if you had like a ruby or a house. You can more easily turn your bank CD into cash without taking a huge hit. But if interest rates have changed, you might not get back what you thought you were going to get. Okay. So anyway, those are some of the issues. But the point is, I just want to make sure you realize banks could still be in the position of taking in a bunch of savings and channeling them to various projects, rather than having the individual savers try to figure out, you know, what projects in the community of the state that have the highest expected return and that kind of stuff. But people, they don't have the expertise to make those decisions. The bank could still perform the role of hiring experts who are loan analysts and blah, blah, blah. But the specific mechanism by which those savings would get channeled to borrowers would be through you can call them savings accounts or time deposits, what have you, but it would not be in the form of checking accounts. Okay, we got one more. We've got 5 minutes left, so we got Don is asking one last question here, and then we'll wrap it up for today. What response would you give to a Marxist who would argue that in the last few years, wealth inequality has gotten larger, just like Marx predicted? Okay, well, I haven't seen the actual data, but let's assume, you know, let's stipulate that it's correct, that wealth inequality really has increased. I would say, well, look, that's certainly not, you can't lay that at the feet of capitalism, the laissez-faire capitalism, because governments around the world, since the crisis struck, have been engaging in all sorts of massive, unprecedented interventions. And so say what you will about that, but that's not the natural unfolding of pure capitalism. And in fact, the purest of, you know, what the Marxists would call apologists for capitalism were the ones complaining the most about those trends. You know, I was against the bailouts from day one, so were all the main people associated with the Mises Institute. So to say, why is it the working class get screwed the last few years while the fat cats are paying themselves bonuses and stuff? Well, it's because the central banks and the governments have been bailing out the big financial institutions while letting the homeowners, you know, get foreclosed upon and that kind of stuff. So I guess that would be my response, Don, is to say that that's certainly not the unfolding of capitalism. And also, it depends too that, I guess, is it true that over the long haul, like in the periods when you saw, how am I trying to put this? You have to be careful about the distinction between standards of living and proportions of income or wealth. So certainly looking at, there was no middle class in the feudal period. I guess that's what I'm trying to get over. There was a very little, you know, you might look at a little individual artisan or something. There's not a huge chunk of the population that was neither super rich but nor serfs. You know, the idea of what we mean by the middle class is an outgrowth of modern capitalism. And so, you know, to blame capitalism for inequality is a bit odd. All right. So it is true that unfettered laissez-faire capitalism, especially in the age of globalism, does open up opportunities for certain individuals to become fantastically wealthy. But that would not have been possible under the old structure. But on the other hand, there is a sense in which, so yeah, Bill Gates right now is richer in relative terms than 99% of the population, more so than arguably even like Louis XIV compared to serfs in terms of multiples of income or whatever, just because Bill Gates, you know, when you start getting the billions, that's just a big number. But in the sense of the difference in the standard of living between Bill Gates and the average person now, at least in the United States, is not that big. The average person right now can still get on a plane and fly to Disney World and stuff. It's just the average person has to fly coach, whereas Bill Gates has his own private jet. All right. And the average person can still go out to eat a lot of restaurants. It's just he'll go to McDonald's or something, whereas Bill Gates will go to a steakhouse. But back in the day, I mean, Louis XIV, the difference in his life compared to the serf, I mean, it wasn't just, oh, Louis XIV had the same thing the serf had, just nicer. No, they were totally different lives. That was not even close. So, I would bring up that kind of point too. All right, guys, we are at the mark here, so we'll stop. Thanks for tuning in, and if you can, try to do your reading ahead of time for next week. I will post the quiz for week one. I generally try to get that posted by Monday, for, you know, for the preceding week. If you're taking the course for credit, that quiz will go up, but I'll blast out the email so you guys will know when it's up. Okay, thanks, guys.